I'm really pleased that Zadie's agreed to do this. Obviously for good kind of literary and intellectual reasons, but also because I was actually in my department at UCL this afternoon, and a student who's scarcely ever spoken to me before stopped me in the corridor and said, is it you who you're interviewing Zadie Smith I saw in the newspaper? And I said, yes, it is me. And she said, but I thought you stopped in the 19th century. So I'm grateful to Zadie also for kind of persuading some of those I teach that I'm in touch with the 21st century. Probably like lots of you here, I first came across Zadie Smith's fiction with White Teeth. And I read it like lots of kind of sober critics. I was determined not to be carried away by it. But that determination was readily baffled by the book. And I was carried away like everybody else. And I followed the fiction since. And although On Beauty is a very different book, some of those things which perhaps we could talk about, that extraordinary ear for people's voices and range of sympathies which were there in the first book are still there, I think. On Beauty's had another salutary effect for me, which is that it's made me reread Howards End. Okay. So I hope we could talk a bit about that too. I had an English teacher who always made us do E.M. Forster for A-level. And he always said, they don't write books like this anymore. And managed almost to persuade us that all the things that Forster is sometimes criticised for were all the things that were kind of best about him. And maybe somewhere, I don't know what's happened to him, maybe somewhere he's reading On Beauty and thinking that actually they do write books like this. Before we get to Forster, I wanted to sort of start by actually asking about the title, Zadie, because I was on my way out. I know it's naff to sort of quote your children, but I was on the way out of my house, and my daughter said to me, "On Beauty, is that the title of the book, or is that what it's about?"
That's a good question.
So yeah, out of the mouths of innocence. It's quite sort of risky to have a title which seems to sort of say what the book's about. I just wondered why you decided to take that risk, really.
Well, I guess the first thing with me in titles is that I choose them very quickly, immediately, and then I never change them, and I don't usually think in too much depth why I chose them. But with On Beauty, once I started, I think I realised that I suppose I think of my fiction as being very essay-like a lot of the time, and it's a trait about it that I don't really like. And I come from an academic background in that I wanted to be an academic, and I was a very keen student, and I think I was a very good essay writer. And when I turned to fiction, I did a lot of the same things, separating it into parts, making arguments, pushing a theme from the beginning to the end. And so when I gave it the title, I thought if I give it an essay's title, but I try and be as open and as broad in the content. It was a kind of joke to myself. I gave it an academic title, but I wanted it to be the freest of my books, basically.
And the beauty in the book, I mean, one of the effects of the title, I suppose on lots of readers, certainly on an academic reader like me, is every time the word beauty appears in it, this kind of, it sort of strikes a chord. And one of the things about beauty in the book that seems ironical given the title is that one of the main characters earns his living lecturing about paintings, and yeah. He seems kind of pretty much impervious to that kind of it's partly about painting, the book, but he seems sort of impervious to the beauty aspect of it.
Yeah, I think it's something that I really felt when I was in college, that a lot of people I was being taught by, who were incredibly brilliant theoreticians and very smart men and were teaching aesthetics were very, very strict about the idea of your kind of affective response to something, whether you found something moving or beautiful or you had a strong feeling for it. And that was kind of just removed from the discussion in a very strict way, which I completely approved of because I was a super theory nerd myself. But then if you went back to their houses or if you knew them more personally, it was clear that there were paintings on the wall and Bach was on the stereo and there was fantastic gourmet food being served. And there was all this, you know, delight and pleasure, and yet it was all being obscured or denied in the college context. And I just always thought that was a weird situation and a weird denial. And it's something to do with the idea that English as a subject or the arts as a subject is really not quite strict enough or not quite formal enough and way too modern. You know, English as a subject in English universities is, I don't know, 1922 or 3 as a separate subject. And I always felt when I was studying it that it just wasn't quite meaty enough, not as good as math, not as serious as science, not proper like physics. And I think what happens in a lot of English departments is the attempt to force that seriousness through other means. And I just thought it was kind of a comic situation. So after 3 years of Cambridge, I had just total contempt for novels. That wasn't really the plan when I arrived. I had a great love for novels, and I came out with a great disgust of them. So when I went to Harvard, I felt when I was trying to teach my students, I was inadvertently giving them a lot of the kind of thing that I'd been taught, and I suddenly realized that this was not really the way I wanted to go about things. So a lot of that kind of seeped into the book one way or another.
So, with the hapless Howard in the novel, what the kind of comedy of it seems even more marked, because whenever he does use the word beauty, doesn't he? But I think, maybe I'm wrong, but the occasions on which I can recall that he uses the word beauty, he uses it to mean sort of sexual allure, really, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting with him because he thinks of, he's part of that whole movement in the Academy that thought of beauty as something kind of indulgent or at the worst, kind of oppressive, where you make choices for reasons which aren't reasons of depth and all the rest of it. But of course, when he's struck by beauty, he's completely flawed. You know, when he meets this incredibly beautiful young girl, he can't control himself at all. And I guess that's not the most enlightened experience of beauty you can have, but it's one of the experiences of beauty, and it's incredibly rewarding to look at something beautiful, to see someone beautiful. It gives you something. So I guess part of the book was allowing Howard to feel that way and also having sympathy for him when it happens. I guess a lot of novels about midlife crisis kind of ridicule the midlife crisis, but I more and more I can see how it happens. I feel for it a bit more. Naturally, people are beautiful, and naturally you're attracted to their beauty. That's what happens.
Yeah. I mean, you actually do a very difficult thing to do. I mean, writers try to do it, have tried to do it, where you actually do the sort of seduction scene where he's seduced by this girl. No, it's good, yeah, it's good, I thought. I mean, it was, you know, and he absolutely knows he shouldn't be doing it now. And it's all the time, but even as he's doing it, he knows he shouldn't be doing it. It's not like a sort of some kind of Philip Roth thing where some sort of dark primal force takes over and everything's forgotten. Even as it's happening, he knows that it is comically ridiculous and also sort of an act of betrayal.
Well, I think that's very. I mean, when I was a kid, I always thought that, you know, that I had this aspiration to be middle class, and I thought that middle class life, once you got there, would be very organized. It wouldn't be the kind of, you know, emotional disasters and messes that I thought working class life or lower middle class life constituted. Then, of course, when you get there, when you meet middle class people, it's exactly the same scenario. Same divorces, same disaster, same children who hate their parents. So that was kind of a revelation for me when I was 18, 19, to realize that knowledge or a certain kind of knowledge doesn't save you from emotional entanglement.
Well, I mean, some people would say, I was going to ask about this a bit later, why so many novelists write about academics. But I mean, some people say that thing about academics is that they have the time to cock things up. You know, they really have the time to make terrible messes of their lives. And perhaps American academics have more time.
I'm better pay as well. I think that's true, but actually I do have a theory about people, why novelists write about academics and sculptors and composers, and it's not a very pretty reason, really. It is, if you end up in my situation where your job is only writing, you lose complete touch with what it is to work. Like most writers I know, the idea of writing a description of an everyday workplace is completely impossible. It's the piece of imagination which is beyond them. So naturally they choose people whose work basically, though it might appear different, is structurally exactly the same. You're alone, you watch daytime TV, you create something. Some people like it, some people don't. So many novels every year, the composer is the main character, or a poet. So it's a kind of displacement of the only experience you have, which is the experience of being at home all the time. And I think it is a bit depressing, and I kind of always knew it was inevitable that I would write a campusy novel at some point. But I hope not to write another, actually, to be honest. One's enough.
But isn't it a bit more than that? I started making a little list of kind of relatively recent novels, which were either campus novels or had one really major part where the central character was an academic. And actually, I started thinking of ones which I thought, oh, yeah, actually, The Corrections.
There's lots.
Oh, actually, Disgrace. I mean, and lots, you know. And the so, on the one hand, there are still sort of relatively light comedies written about academics, but all these kind of serious books by Philip Roth and Saul Bellow, they're all about academics.
It gives
you
a lot of room, like Jonathan's book, that's a good example. It gives him the chance to complain about various movements in contemporary thought that he dislikes, then also to show kind of a debate between two different sides of thought. It gives you a lot of space to write a certain thing without writing, I suppose, riffs, which maybe a lot of novelists of my age or around my age kind of fear writing. It's a way to do it with action instead of, here's three pages about why I hate your average liberal or, you know, whatever. This is not a good practice in fiction. So it's a way of disguising all of that. And also I think, particularly in the beginning of The Corrections, it throws up ideas that he then disseminates through the family members, through the empathic characters in that book. I think it works pretty well. But you're right, it's everywhere.
But it's also that thing that On Beauty is about, which is about the kind of, well, I suppose the cliché would be feet of clay, but their kind of comic mismatch between intellectual aspirations and pretensions and, you know, people's actual motivations. So it's a brilliant, hilarious conversation. One of those conversations where Howard's trying to sort of talk to Kiki, his wife, about what he's done. And he sort of lapses into an appallingly plausible sort of seminar speak.
Yeah,
I'm finding
language.
It difficult to make a narrative out of this, you know.
It is. It's awful between the two. But I think it's easier to ridicule Howard because there's a natural animosity which comes towards academics or ivory tower or that general argument, which actually I don't have. I like academic life, and there's a lot of me which would have liked to have done that. But I think the problem with the two of them are just two completely different language systems. Kiki's always also coming from a language which is slightly phony, not really hers, from television, from self-help books, from kind of emotional novels that she's read and all this kind of thing. So they're just two different kinds of dialogue coming up against each other. But I guess I also want to show with Howard that people who think of themselves as extreme rationalists think they have no sentimental side or no... the best way to put it is religious side. I've been reading this great book by William James, Henry James's brother, The Varieties of Religious Experience. He does this incredible thing of just making the simplest definition of religion is that a person recognises a lack, something is wrong, you recognise that you and your state are not quite right. Then the second position is knowing that at least you know that there's something good there and there's a connecting with a more than good somewhere in the world which will improve you or make it right. So when I'm writing, I realise from reading this book, that's what I'm always thinking about, that people who maybe don't consider themselves religious, Howard doesn't consider himself religious, but he lives by a religion, he lives by a faith, which in his case is this incredible principle of being a rationalist, not being a sentimentalist. And Kiki also has her kind of unspoken moments of faith. Faith is just, according to William James, what you're willing to live by. And it's the contradiction of all these different people living but for quite different reasons and also being in denial of the reasons they're living, which interests me, I guess.
But when he's doing his... you don't get Kiki's... She's a hospital administrator, isn't she?
Yes. Workplace I couldn't imagine.
You get his workplace, and in his workplace, a wonderful seminar he gives. I don't know if it's sort of somehow caught from life or... But
I've been to some bad seminars, yes. I've given some bad seminars.
Have you? You haven't said what we're trying to interrogate here is the mytheme of Arthur's autonomous individual.
No, I'm not there.
But there are plenty of people who do say that. I mean, his sort of academic life is completely phony, isn't it?
Well, but the thing is, I particularly when I read the book in America, I felt a lot of people were kind of hooraying in the audience because I thought I was just wanted to take down that kind of, I guess you call it postmodern theory. But actually, that's not how I feel at all. And a lot of those theorists, particularly Derrida, particularly Foucault, I think were the greatest of their kind. It's not that theory which I object to, because a lot of that theory really transformed me when I was really young and helped me do almost everything I do. It's what comes afterwards, and it's completely natural because a university is a place where people have to make a living and you have to professionalize things, and so little departments are made and maybe they're slightly debased from the original idea and the language gets a bit sloppy and then you find yourself talking about the mytheme of nothing or whatever. I wrote plenty of essays that I read now when I was in college that I literally don't comprehend because they don't make any sense. They never made any sense. And it's that kind of sloppy secondary thinking which is a bit depressing. And more than anything, I think I felt when I was teaching, if I came to class fully armed with that stuff, there were kids sitting there who they really wanted to make a connection with the books we were reading, and I'd stop them being able to do that almost immediately. And that's a sad thing. And then they get nervous and they think, oh, well, I won't try. And then it gets into this incredibly complicated relationship. So part of it, I just for me when I was teaching, is realizing that you don't have to be the genius. You know, it's okay for everybody to come together, admit what they don't know, say, here's a lacuna in my knowledge, I never read this, I don't know that. And it's okay to be that person, not to have to talk from the mount, which is, I think, what I thought teaching was.
There's a kind of the most tragicomic sentence in the novel, actually, was quite near the end, when he and Kiki have kind of separated because of his second affair. And he's going to go off and do this important lecture, because he's quite a failure actually as an academic, isn't he? I mean, age 57, he hasn't got tenure,
so well,
you know.
Yeah.
Poor. and he's going off and he's kind of consoling himself. I mean, it's sort of, we're sort of inside his head, and he's sort of consoling himself with these sort of thoughts about what might come of this lecture. He might get a better job. It says, it was in a university that he must now put all his remaining hope.
Yeah,
I thought that was one of the
very
most tragic sentences of contemporary fiction.
No, that is sad. There's a really great line of Forster where he says that he thinks that the intimate life is the real life forever and ever. And I suppose I really do believe that. I know that people put a lot of stock in their work and their career and all the rest of it, but I can't help thinking that the intimate life, the domestic life, is the centre of everything. It's the only thing that stays around that was worth anything at the end. So it's a sad thing for Howard that he's has to move.
Well, maybe can I ask you a bit about the Forster? Because the beauty, what we were you were saying about the title, I don't know if you were deliberately, as it were, pushing the reader or the swotty reader towards this, but it pushed me towards the passage from one of the most famous chapters, I think, of Howard's End, The Concert, which is a chapter you directly imitate. And in Howard's End, of course, it's the Beethoven Fifth Symphony, and it's where Leonard Bast comes across the Schlegels. I mean, kind of disastrous, you know. It's ruins him and then kills him, actually, in the end, doesn't it, that encounter. But there's the umbrellas business, and there's a whole sort of little paragraph about beauty in that, about how he pursues beauty. And that word is used three times by Forster, but Forster sort of doing free indirect speech of Leonard. And beauty is what he's after, but something always distracts him, because basically he's poor, he doesn't have time, he doesn't have a sort of private income like the Schlegels. And beauty there seems to be kind of, well, it's what the Schlegels have got, isn't it? It's kind of culture and it's sort of understanding paintings and music.
It's everything that's inessential. Howard's End isn't my favourite Forster book, but I love it really for that section, and particularly for Leonard Bast, who I think is such an extraordinary character. Actually, there's something Forster says about him when I say not following anyone into a workplace. He said he couldn't follow them into their home because he'd always lived a upper middle class life. He couldn't imagine what it would be like to live this poor life. But Leonard, the thing about pursuing beauty when he meets those Schlegel sisters, which is a moment, they're trying so hard, the Schlegel sisters, who I think Forster inferred were based on Virginia Woolf and Vanessa Bell, this kind of lovely, intellectual, vibrant, upper-middle-class girls. But they can't understand about Leonard the difference between feeling entitled or not feeling entitled. That's what that whole scene is about, when he comes around to the house. Because to them, it's perfectly natural. You make a joke, you make a little comment, a slight, but to him, every word is, you know, it's everything. And if you make a slight about him, some joke about his clothes, or it's everything. And you can't just pass over these things smoothly. And I feel that very much, like, I guess when I was writing this one, I was thinking about maybe my younger brother's friends or people I know from school, and if we go out somewhere, there's such a difference in, I guess, a sense of entitlement that I've grown into, which is so far from what I felt when I was a kid. So it's that that's the difference, that you can't communicate across it, and the Schlegels try so hard, they try so hard to make the boy feel welcome, but everything they do makes him feel like, you are not my people, you are from a different place, you don't understand me. And also that the idea of him pursuing beauty, they approve of it, but they find the way he does it kind of vulgar. You know, it's he's going to walk through a bluebell forest till the next day to see the sunset, and they romanticize it, but the moment they've romanticized it, they've destroyed it. It's that strange thing in England of the classes just not really comprehending each other, even when they try.
You're a lot more sort of merciful to Carl. You're
yes.
kind of...
I think I want to give him
a break.
Than
yeah. Forster is to Leonard Bass.
Yeah, it's true.
Because Carl is a kind of... I mean, he is the sort of... You're invited to think as a reader who's read any Forster that he is the equivalent of and there's some of the same kind of... when he visits the Belsies' home
yeah.
for the party,
absolutely.
There's some of the same kind of uncomprehending... condescension to him, isn't there?
I think so, but I wanted to kind of, I suppose, emphasise when I was thinking of Levi and Carl, actually, that they don't want what the Belsies have in the way that Leonard does want what the Schlegels have. They have something else, and Levi is very conscious, for instance, of the beauty of what he considers, what he's chosen to be his culture, hip-hop. He's just made a decision. It's not, I suppose he considers it in his nature, but he's chosen this thing and he's pursued it. And he's happy there. And Carl has a kind of confidence, I guess you call it street confidence or whatever, that isn't can't really be shaped by these people. They can I swear?
Yes.
They kind of fuck with him a little, I guess. but they don't. There's something at the core of him which can't be disturbed, and also that drop that Forster describes between the middle class, lower middle class, and working class, so severe financially, so extraordinary. The idea that if Leonard loses a job, that's it. That
yeah.
might be it forever. He
the
might
abyss.
Die in the gutter.
The
it's
abyss
quite
is the word, yeah.
And one thing I suppose you could say for England after welfare state is it's not the abyss at that point. There's plenty of moments to fall in the abyss, but it's not like that. It's not just a swipe into nothing.
But there's also a kind of compensating comedy in your novel, actually, as well as the condescension, there's a kind of, I don't know, inverted snobbery or something, an awkwardness, which in the university, this kind of lovely, well-tended kind of university in Massachusetts manifests itself in all sorts of kind of rather awkward moves to kind of show how open they are
yeah.
to other people.
Well, I think that's right, but it's the same. It goes all the way back to kind of, I don't know, like a Virgilian pastoral. You always have the idea that these simple people are authentic in some way, and that never changes. It just happens that these kids are black kids, and I suppose a certain kind of white liberal life in America imagines that blackness has some authenticity that whiteness doesn't have, which is incomprehensible. How could anyone be more authentic than anyone else? But Levi, you know, himself believes it, that somehow he's lacking sufficient blackness. So all those kind of bizarre metaphysical ideas, I'm not black enough, I'm not white enough, I'm not that kind of interests me, and the comedy they produce where you can't, I mean, how could you be other than you are? But this kind of searching for something to be more of what you are, I find really weird, I guess, and comic. It is funny.
Why did you decide you wanted to model your novel on another novel?
I think it's a lot of things. Like since I did it, people have pointed out other examples like Graham Swift and Helen Fielding, and it's kind of English tradition of going a few books back. And
well, I mean, last month at the book club, where we had Sarah Walters talking about Fingersmith,
yeah.
and kind of quite a lot of the plot tricks of Fingersmith. I mean, they're fine, they're great on their own, but if you read The Woman in White, they're much
Absolutely,
better.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think White Teeth and London Fields had similar relationship, as Martin pointed out to me. So that those kind of things, I think, to be honest, a few things. One was, as I thought of the book, my husband pointed out the connection, and I thought that's kind of interesting that Howard's End is so deep in my subconscious that I just think of it as a foundation story. Also, it sounds completely sentimental, but I did have this special feeling for Forster when I was very young, and I wanted to somehow pay tribute to that. But thirdly, and I think most strongly, ever since I started writing, I've always needed I think of it in my mind as scaffolding, and all my books have had scaffolding of some kind. And then quite often, as I'm halfway through them, I realise that I didn't really need the scaffolding. Why did I set it all up, these various chapters in a certain way, or in the Autograph Man, this complicated situation of symbols and or contrast. And once you start writing, you feel confident. Of course you didn't need this thing, but it's there, and you keep it. And there are ways, I know plenty of writers who remove it afterwards. It's a process you can do, but I guess with this one, the moment I was into the book, I saw that, it doesn't matter, really. But then it became a pleasure to meet it at various points to say, here is this meeting, here is that one. But
it has quite sort of delicious effect sometimes. You must have been aware.
Sometimes,
like the thing we were talking about, the concert.
Yeah.
And the meeting with Carl / Leonard Bast. And when you hear the Belses, and they're actually repeating something you recognise, but they don't think they are. They think they're just being themselves, and yet they're comically, because part in a way some kinds of comedy come when people think that they're being individual,
exactly,
but in fact they're not. You've heard it all before.
I think I read a review. Some guy, I think it was on the internet, who said, and I thought it was completely accurate, that it was an expression on my part of a real crisis of faith in the whole idea of plotting a novel. I think that's absolutely true. I have a big problem with even me writing this kind of book, just that kind of basically 19th century realism, kind of plodding along. And it's not that I don't enjoy novels like that. I do, and I feel writing this was one of the greatest enjoyments I ever had, because it was such a indulgence. Because if you ask me as a critic or in my mind when I think about theories of books or writing about other people's books, I want newness in fiction, and I admire experiment and modernity, but I still have this nostalgic feeling for these other books. So it was a strange process. It let me free to do things that I wouldn't normally do, and I think it made the plotting looser and not so panicked. I think it's the only book of mine in which the end isn't a kind of hyper fit of fear, what's going to happen, because I really felt that I did know. But I don't know. I suppose I admire books which are total freestanding acts of imagination, and yet when you go through novels, so few are. And then people's scaffolding is so different. I'm reading this biography of Joyce, the Richard Ellman one, and it's just extraordinary to read Ulysses for what it is, a massive record of every detail in Dublin, like the man who sold him fish and the woman who first taught him to read and his cousin's sister, and on and on and on. It's like Yellow Pages, that book. And it's so extraordinary to know that somehow, even though he had this fantastic fictive imagination, he needed all these things, these real things to balance the book on. So I guess mine isn't life, mine is other books, which is evident in all my books, that I'm a person who's from books. But I guess when I think about writing again, I hope that I'll have some long life gap in between. I was just saying backstage, I feel like I've been reading, since I was five. I need to do something that isn't book related.
Because there are some bits of On Beauty where the closeness to the Forster, it's not, I mean, you call it scaffolding, but that's kind of, that's quotation,
there
and
is.
There's really in elaborate, the... and there's characters who, I was looking today at the episode, again, it's quite a famous episode in Howard's End, where the Wilcox family gather to look at this note which has left, Ruth Wilcox has left. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant
piece.
Fantastic. Which Ruth Wilcox has left, just sort of saying, oh, by the way, give the house to Margaret Schlegel.
Yeah.
Miss Schlegel, brackets Margaret.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they sit and or stand and decide. And you have a parallel passage in On Beauty.
It's absolutely
when that
true.
Painting,
you know, that scene's from Mansfield Park, Forster's scene, you know, when they're arguing about with how much money to give the...
Yes.
And it gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah, Sense and Sensibility.
Yeah, Sense and Sensibility, you're right, yeah. Sorry. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of... quotation. I find interesting. I can't really defend it. It's ridiculous.
No. But it's, it's pleasurable. So like, even the sort of Michael's got a bride to be, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Amelia.
Absolutely.
And she's sort of acting as though she's part of the family, but she's not really. Yet.
Yeah.
And in under this pressure, yeah. You can suddenly see that they don't really have much time for her.
Absolutely.
And it's absolutely in Howard's End, there's Dolly, isn't she? Who's going to marry Charles?
I know.
And they say, "Shut up, you know."
Yeah, stop being such a fool. But those family scenes.
And they say
Forster,
the same thing.
Yeah.
They say, "Oh, it's in pencil. Pencil doesn't count."
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's those family scenes that I love most, and I guess I wanted to play with. And then once the characters move away from the scene, all kinds of things develop that I didn't imagine. So it's that point, the train point, and I guess the very beginning, the first line. But then, because, for instance, with Jerome and his father, there's no real relationship like that in Howard's End, so then you move it around, then you switch, and it's kind of a game, and it kind of entertains me as I write. But it's completely insane. I don't know why I do it.
Actually... In the 18th century, they were really into this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Because they actually imitated, they even printed books. Admittedly, we're not talking about novels now, but poems, which would be called an imitation. And you'd have the original printed on one side and the clever new version by Alexander Pope on
Absolutely.
The other, so you could see where it came together and where it departed. And Fielding's first novel, Joseph Andrew, said, you know, written in imitation of Don Quixote. And you were supposed to kind of see that.
I know. I guess it's the same when I read Nabokov. He has various moments like that of the clues being left. And some people obviously find Nabokov completely infuriating exactly for that reason. And Borges is the same thing, those kind of literary games. But I have a terrible weakness for them. I can't help it. but I guess it is kind of one side of my brain. And then other times, I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm not very good at explaining
it. What about Forster's kind of... I sort of said flippantly about my English teacher, and how he used to say all the best things about Forster were the things that had gone out of fashion, and everybody said were the worst things about him. And I think he was thinking of things like his extraordinary sort of authorial interventions
and random deaths.
Yes,
people
and
just dying
coincidences
for no reason, yeah.
And passages of weird stuff about England.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, I was reading your sort of you imitate some of those too, don't you? Because there's a little bit about Hampstead Heath, which seems like your version of his. He has a bit about the Isle of Purbeck in.
Oh, I don't remember the Isle of Purbeck now. Jesus, no, that one's passed me by. I always knew I wanted to write a piece about Hampstead Heath. To be honest, that could have gone in any of my novels. I just really wanted to have on record the fact that it's the greatest park in the world. So I'm glad that that's all done now. What was I saying?
Well, about his about
oh Forster yeah.
stepping in and sort of telling
Absolutely.
Us things.
Well, I wrote an essay. I'm writing these essays on 20th century fiction. And one of them's on Forster, and you're right. He has all these incredible faults. And when you talk to other novelists, particularly if they say to me, "I hear you like Forster," it's with pity in their faces, pity and shame. And I can see all those problems with him. But the other truth about writers, particularly writers who write criticism. And a lot of other younger novelists I know are writing criticism at the moment, is that you prepare the ground for the books you write. It's perfectly obvious. I mean, if you look at Virginia Woolf's criticism or Eliot's criticism, they're always writing essays that seem to prefer the kind of writing that they happen to do. So that's always part of a writer-critic's instinct. But I guess I have a kind of slightly more self-flagellating instinct when I write criticism in that it's writing quite different from mine that I like. But with Forster, I suppose... I picked up habits from him. I don't have his best skills. His best skills are uncopyable. They're really quite extraordinary. And it's just a massive gift of empathy, which is never foreshortened in the way that mine is. Sometimes I just don't like the person enough to make the extra effort. Whereas I always feel with Forster that he makes the effort in quite difficult circumstances.
He doesn't make the effort with Jackie.
No, he's horrible to Jackie,
yeah,
that's true.
Yeah,
he's awful to her.
I'm not expecting you to exculpate him from this, but there's this terrible bit, which I've forgotten all about, when the Bass are dragged up to Shropshire for the Wedding by Helen Schlegel.
Yes.
And Bast has lost his job because of Wilcox's advice. And Jackie, and they're presented to Margaret.
Yes.
By Helen, and it says, there is Mrs. Bast too, prompted Helen. Jackie also shook hands. She, like her husband, was shy and furthermore ill. And then just as you're thinking, right, I mean, Helen's made them do this ludicrous journey. They haven't eaten enough. They're living somewhere terrible. It says, and furthermore ill, and furthermore, so bestially stupid, but she could not grasp what was happening.
Well, he's not, he has a big problem. He finds it hard. Certain kinds of women, I think he does have a bit of trouble with, that's true. But I think, obviously he's a writer with lots of problems, but one of the things that I'm trying to do in this book of criticism is understand that you can't be all the writers all the time. You know, so I don't go to Forster to get what I could get from Kafka, and I don't go to Kafka to get what I could get from Nabokov. And that kind of, you know, is the great variety of fiction. And what I go to for Forster is, it really is an education of the heart in that Aristotelian manner. That's what he does. Many other things he makes a terrible mess of, but really, so what? If you see what I mean? If you read widely, then you have the opportunity to be all these writers. As a reader, that's how I feel. I read all these writers and I'm with them in all these different parts of what used to be called the human condition, and that's okay. But I don't demand from Forster things that he couldn't possibly deliver, given his life, his restriction, his class. You know, that's what to be expected.
And do you think in your book you learnt things from, because your book's a lot about love, actually, and its unlikely persistence when indeed some of the characters are behaving as if it's not there, but it is. And part of the trick of the book, the successful trick of the book, is to get us to believe characters love each other when actually they're behaving in such a way that the objects of their love hardly see the truth of that. But Howard's End, is about love, but I think a lot of people would say, well, that was, you know, that's one of the problems of Howard's End. I mean, an interesting and animating problem, but after all, what I think, apart from coincidences, the thing that most people find hardest to bite on is Margaret Schlegel marrying Henry Wilcox.
Yeah, no, me too, absolutely. Yeah. It's really hard, and I when I watched the film not long ago, I thought it particularly shows in the film when they're physically in front of you.
Yes.
Emma Thompson and Anthony Hopkins, you can't abide the idea. They both do such a good job of playing these characters that you can't believe.
And Forster even
it's as if
he knows it, because he even describes what it's like to kiss Henry Wilcox, doesn't he? And how she's really looking forward to this kiss. You know, they've suddenly gone from Miss Schlegel to Margaret, and then she gets this terribly perfunctory kiss, and he's off.
I think it's one of it's a novelist thing where you're trying to make an argument, which is what he's trying to make, and his main concern is about look at these people of money and practical ability compared to people of intellect and liberal intention. So he's forced to do this marriage, and then actually as an afterthought, as a novelist, you think, oh, but what are the practicalities of this man, this woman, physically with each other? So sometimes I think for people who don't like those kind of systematized novels, then it's just too offensive, it's ridiculous, and you haven't gone with your heart and your instinct, and it's all wrong. For me, though, I think when Forster is led into a direction which his structure is forcing him to, it's interesting, the fallout, because then he has to deal with it, and he has to kind of deal with it on his feet, and some of it's done better than other bits. But towards the end, I could see how he's trying to make you believe that Margaret Schlegel has a heart so wide that it's able to contain someone really quite opposite to her in almost every way, and also to give this great act of what is basically religious pity and redemption to him when she finds out that he's sinned. And also to show that she's a terrible prig. The sin is an awful thing to her. She's meant to be this great liberal lady, but actually she's outraged that he cheated on his wife. So I think it works out in the end. It makes Forster raise his game. Now he has to work to make the thing happen.
And you talk, just one last thing before I throw it open to anybody here. I mean, you talked about how that something I something close to what I said about your novels, actually, about the kind of how he sympathises with different characters. And one of the things he does, which sometimes, again, gets up the nose of, I think, academic critics, is he sort of switches viewpoint, gets very kind of almost, it seems to some opportunistically, you suddenly get a thought from one character, just one thought. And then he's off. I mean,
and it's transvestite as well. Occasionally, the third person voice in this appears to be a woman.
Yes.
Really, it's the strangest thing. There's about two different, maybe three different paragraphs where he seems to be referring to himself, and the person he's referring to seems to be female. It's really, really weird.
So, did you when you were writing on Beauty, there are some characters whose heads we don't get into. For the obvious one, I suppose, is Monty Kipps.
I think it's Monty. I also think it's Jerome. And about 2 days ago, I was coming out of my house, just about to go to the pub with my husband, and it never happened to me before. A whole section of the book that I should have written just literally came into my mind. I couldn't believe it, and I saw what Jerome should have done and what he was interested in. And it was spurred by reading something quite random, actually, an article about Jonathan Miller in the paper. Suddenly all kinds of things fell into place, and it was the strangest. It's too late, obviously, yeah. It's after the fact. But I think a lot of those things are just exhaustion. Writing a novel is quite a tedious job, in my opinion, a very long one, and sometimes you just give up, you cut things short. With Monty, I think I'm always very interested in a kind of, I don't know how to describe it, like a perverse conservatism, I suppose. I really like people like Evelyn Waugh and Kingsley Amis, and there's something about English men like that which I find very funny, the way they wind people up so intensely, and particularly wind people like me up so intensely, deliberately, that I find comic. So I wanted Monty to be that type of person, but actually they're very complicated men. It's more difficult than they're just there to wind up liberals. And the truest thing in the book, the truest to my feeling, is when Monty says, you know, the problem with people like you is you don't believe that people like me are serious. And this is not just a pose to irritate you, this is how I feel. And I guess at the bottom line is I couldn't really imagine how Monty felt all the way down. I could see him as a kind of perverse conservative, but I couldn't really believe on his deathbed that these would be his views. But the truth is, I think they are his views, but I just couldn't make that leap.
It makes him actually peculiarly powerful in
yes.
the book. Because
you don't get into him at
because,
all.
You know, for the novelist, for a good novelist, sympathising with the characters and seeing things, however briefly, from their point of view, is partly a matter of being true to their weaknesses. And so because you don't get that with Monty, he seems, I mean, like the great set piece of the faculty debate, which
yes.
is hilarious,
it's quite, yeah.
where Howard tries to get him banned from lecturing. Because you know how Howard's feeling. He's absolutely, you can see he's hopeless.
Yeah,
he's totally doomed. And because you don't know how Monty's feeling.
I think you don't know what he lives by, that's the thing. And I don't know. You know what he professes to live by, but that just seems too ludicrous or just for show. But I suppose I didn't really know what really motivated him all the way down.
I meant to ask you about the ending of the novel, because that literally is about not talking about things, isn't it? Because Howard, of course, he's driving to this lecture, and it being a campus novel, I'm afraid I expected him to crash, because
yes.
in campus novels, academics always crash their cars. I don't
drive.
Know if you noticed that.
Yeah, it's true.
But they're thought of as being incapable of driving. And,
it's true, but you know, at the end of Panin, he gets away in his little car, finally is squeezed between two delivery trucks and goes off into the sunset. There's a lovely moment which I really like, and that moment, Panin is one of my favourite books, if not my favourite book. That little moment of letting the character escape both the novelist and the reader is something that I really like. And I kind of wanted to get that at the end of this book, just an ambiguity. So these people aren't your little toys anymore. Because I think part of the problem with psychological realism is you give the reader so much power, you know, watch these people's lives and observe them move this way and that. And it's quite nice to show that certain things in life are ineffable, and it's really none of your business if these people are going to stay married or not, or whether it's going to work out, or it's not like watching television, you know. Sometimes these things just escape you, and it also escaped me. I have no answer for it, but it was quite nice giving them their inviolability, I think is what you call it.
Okay, well, thanks very much
Thank
to Sadie
much.
For coming
thanks.
Here